We hold these truths to be self-evident? As you know well, they were not self-evident to even your great Greeks. Aristotle, some were born to rule and some were born to be ruled. I remember going to India. The Dalits, they're untouchable. The Brahmins, fly above them. Those founding principles are self-evident to readers of the Bible, but to nobody else. And we've got to go back to them and know why we believe in them.
I write in my book about the misconceptions that people seem to think that, you know, Jefferson came up with these ideas.
No, no, it's ludicrous.
Or that these ideas leap from the French Enlightenment. And you think, no, 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 they do not. They come from the Bible. There's no way around it. Welcome to Socrates in the City. We find ourselves today in the city of Washington, D.C. It's my privilege today to speak with someone who, if he weren't right here, I would go on and on and on about, because it is because of him, Oz Guinness, my guest, that Socrates in the City exists. I won't tell that story now, but that is true. So I'm particularly gratified to have Oz as my guest. And of course, he's been our guest at Socrates in the City many times before. But today, because it's the 250th anniversary of the birth of the nation, we are talking often to our guests about the revolution and the founding. And today I will be speaking to Oz about one of his most recent books, The Magna Carta of Humanity, Sinai's Revolutionary Faith and the Future of Freedom. But this is, of course, only one of Oz's many, many books. Let me tell you a little bit about Oz. He is an author and social critic. He's the great, great, great grandson of Arthur Guinness, the Dublin brewer. In case you haven't heard of Guinness, now you know. Oz was born in China during World War II, where his parents were medical missionaries, a witness to the climax of the Chinese Revolution in 1949, and we'll speak about that. He was expelled with many other foreigners in 1951 and returned to Europe, where he was educated in England. He completed his undergraduate degree at the University of London and has his DPhil in the social sciences from Oriel College, Oxford. He's written or edited more than 30 books, several of which have had a big influence on me, especially A Free People's Suicide. Oz, since moving to the United States in 1984, has been a guest scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Studies, a guest scholar and visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, senior fellow at the Trinity Forum and the East-West Institute in New York. He was the lead drafter of the Williamsburg Charter in 1988, a celebration of the bicentennial of the U.S. Constitution, and later of the Global Charter of Conscience, which was published at the European Union Parliament in 2012. Oz has spoken at many of the world's major universities and spoken widely to political and business conferences across the world. And he lives here in Washington, D.C., with his lovely wife, who's also a friend, Jenny. Oz Guinness, welcome.
Thank you, Eric. A real delight.
I cannot believe... every time I turn around, you write a book that teaches me something extremely important that I didn't know before. It happened when you wrote your book, A Free People's Suicide, and you introduced me to this idea of the golden triangle of freedom, which I want to touch on. You do it again in this book, The Magna Carta of Humanity, Sinai's Revolutionary Faith and the Future of Freedom. So let me just publicly thank you.
Well,
it really is amazing to me. You, I think that a lot of times people who write books and thinkers, they're just rehashing things, very rarely saying something that's itself somehow revolutionary. And I don't want to embarrass you, but you've done that at least twice, and you've affected my view of the world and things and what I write about. So this book, The Magna Carta of Humanity, if you don't mind, before we get into the deeper conversation, if you just sum up the thesis so that people know what it is the book's about.
Well, put simply, a lot of people talk about making America great again. They don't ask what really made it great in the first place. And for many people, the forgotten key is the way the American Republic owes everything to the rediscovery of the Hebrew Republic. And so that particular book is on the biblical, the Jewish, the Hebrew roots that gave so much of the grounding and foundation to the American Republic.
And you contrast the American founding with, for example, the French Revolution.
Absolutely. I mean, you can see today, just as the Apostle Paul, said to the Galatians, who's bewitched you? You came to faith through grace, and now you're relying on works. And I'm saying, in a way, to America, you came to faith through one revolution, largely biblical, through the rediscovery of the Hebrew Republic, and now you're following the ideas from the French Revolution. And they are disastrous. And Americans have got to make that choice, just as Lincoln set up a choice. You can't be half slave, half free. You can't be half 1776 and half 1789. They go in entirely different directions.
Well, talk a little bit about that for those who are not as familiar with these ideas. I mean, for me, in writing my book on the revolution, I was just genuinely astonished to see how clear this is. I mean, I had some sense of it, but when you do the research and you read the founders and you read it, you just think, how can everyone not know about this? This is just everywhere. But part of the reason I wrote my book and part of the reason I want to talk to you about this book is I think, in fact, many educated people have no idea about this.
No, you're right. Now, this is the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution. It's the 500th anniversary of Tyndale's translation, the first translation from the original language into English. Now, if you think of the influence of the Bible, Wycliffe, Tyndale, the Geneva Bible, King James Bible, the rediscovery of the Bible. In other words, you look at the early church, they made a mistake of copying Rome. You know, Rome had Caesar, consuls, senators, and lo and behold, the church had popes, cardinals, bishops. In other words, hierarchical. And you know the most famous saying on power, Lord Acton, all power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's, here is a Catholic layman, he was Catholic, disagreeing with his own church. Because hierarchical power is based on ranking and power. Power not only oppresses the weak, it corrupts the powerful. And in the Reformation, they say, what does the Bible teach? Hierarchical power? No, covenantal power. And that rediscovery is what lies behind the American experiment. The Mayflower Compact is a covenant. The Arbella, you know, John Winthrop's great sermon, A Model of Christian Charity, is a covenant. You know, and he was called by Cotton Mather an American Nehemiah. And John Adams says, we owe more to the Jews than to any other race. And you can see how the covenant ideas underlie America.
This is so foundational. This has happened to me with you at least once before. You have an insight so outrageous and important, but being an Englishman, you're very diffident, and you pretend, well, everyone sort of knows this. I'm here as the brash American to say, you are wrong. Almost no one knows this, and if not for you, almost no one would continue, almost everyone would continue not to know it. What you're saying, again, I've discovered in part through you, is so central to what America is, who we were, what we've been, who we're meant to be. What would you say accounts for people not getting this so that we get to a point where it falls to you to re-educate us on what we all should know long before you tell us about it?
I'm not the only one, of course, but Bob Bella in 1976, the bicentennial, the most famous book then was The Broken Covenant, a very powerful book on the way the covenant had just slowly been ignored. So covenant became constitution and became legal and lost the moral. And the sense of the collective solidarity at the heart of the covenant, love your neighbor as yourself and so on, became individualism and self-interest. No one, Lyndon Johnson talked about the covenant with the land. Well, that isn't the covenant. And then Bill Clinton talked about the new covenant briefly and then forgot it because he fell foul of other problems. But that notion of covenant, which is absolutely critical to the founding, has almost disappeared. Now, of course, it's biblical. You'd think it'd be kept alive by the churches, but sadly, not.
Well, I guess that's why I'm so shocked, Oz, that as I have discovered this largely through you, I almost can't believe that I hadn't heard it before. I mean, I was a kid at the Bicentennial, and I'd never heard of Robert Bella. Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Bella?
Bella, yeah.
Never heard of Robert Bella or that book, and never heard of these things. And so, but once I hear it from you, it just seems so clear. It's so obvious. But it's not being taught in schools.
Well, there is a new tradition.
Yeah.
It was started by Daniel Elazar, a Jewish scholar. And, you know, he thought, we all think Greek, and you're Greek, of course, and you think monarchy, aristocracy, democracy, with their corrupt forms too, tyranny, oligarchy, mob rule. And so we think Greek immediately. That's 101 in politics. And Daniel Alessa said, no, that's looking at governments. But you've got to look at societies. And if you look at societies, you have hierarchical societies based on power. You have organic societies based on kinship and blood ties. You know, like the Lebanon today, or Arabian tribes and so on. And then you have the rare one, covenantal societies. The big three, Israel, Switzerland, and the United States. And America owes everything to covenantal republicanism.
Well, in writing my book on the Revolution, it became very clear to me that the men of the Revolution, before the Revolution and during the Revolution, before the founding, really, they got this.
Mm-hmm.
It was... And like many things that everybody gets, because they get it, they're not explicit about it because they think, well, why would we need to be explicit? Everyone knows. John Adams, clear as a bell about we are looking, that these ideas come out of the Reformation, that these are Puritan ideas. Samuel Adams, clear as a bell on these things. On August 1st, 1776, he gives a speech in Independence Hall, outside Independence Hall. We have this day restored the sovereign, capital S.
Mm-hmm.
He's making it clear as a bell. We're pointing back to Sinai, that
and
we're going John to govern Adam, ourselves.
When John Adams writes the first constitution, Massachusetts, what does he call it? A covenant.
In what year, roughly?
Okay, you got me on that.
Yeah.
In 1780-something.
Yeah.
But he calls it a covenant. And of course, you look at Jefferson and Franklin, not the most devout of the founders. Both of them choose things from Exodus. And if you stop, as scholars say, what was the book most quoted in the revolutionary era? Not John Locke, not Hobbes, Cicero, Machiavelli, or anything. It was Deuteronomy. And Exodus is the founding of God's nation, the first covenant.
Mm.
But Deuteronomy is the renewal. And the whole of Exodus, which takes place the last month in Moses' life, is in the shape of a covenant. And they understood that very, very well.
Well, this idea of the covenant in Sinai, you mentioned, Franklin and Jefferson, when asked to come up with a seal for the new nation in 1776,
yeah.
Both of them,
mm-hmm.
And these, you know, everybody points at them, oh, they're the deists, they're not Christians, which is not quite true. But the both of them come up with images of the Israelites in the wilderness. They get it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a narrative everyone gets, including them. And as I said, we have forgotten this. This is so central, and it explains really everything.
I feel strongly about it as an Englishman, because in England, it was the last cause. It failed. The English Republic only lasted 10 years, and the king came back. And now, 200 odd years later, freedom in England has almost disappeared with the dismal present government. That's why it's worth fighting for it here, because the American Republic, as it was set up, not as it is today, people have forgotten it. The American Republic, as it was set up, is the only counter to the whole trend in the world, which is towards authoritarianism and totalitarianism. We need a counter with a high view of human dignity, strong view of freedom, and all these things. The American Republic has the key, and that's why I fight for it.
Well, I again, in doing my research, this is, you know, at this point in my life, I cannot pretend that I have known these things for decades as you have. But I really, I'm astonished to see how England almost gets it and then loses it. And so by the time of the revolution or the run-up to the revolution, you have these British subjects in the colonies trying to persuade Parliament, this is your constitution. This is, try to hold them accountable to say, but these are your ideas, you know, and they are not so interesting.
But the reason it failed is a good warning to America today, because, you know, they were very clear on the negative, all the problems of the tyranny of the king and all that. But on the covenantal principles, the first principles that are positive, they weren't clear.
In England.
In England, and fell apart. And if you think the weakness today, many people talk of these things as conservatism.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've often talked to people coming to Washington. They come and say, well, we're MAGA supporters, for example. And I say, terrific. But what do you, for you, made America great in the first place?
Right.
Well, it was Christian, biblical. All right. Give me three things that were the principles. They can't tell you. In other words, today we need the positive, not just the...
Right.
Everyone knows the problems of the left, or at least they should do if their eyes are open. But we need people who understand the positive and can put it in place and we can live by it.
Okay, so this brings us to the French Revolution, because to me this is the classic case. The French knew that the aristocracy, the monarchy, the church allied with the monarchy are oppressive elites. We know that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
But what they propose...
It's terrible.
...to counter it completely fails.
It was worse.
And ends up being worse. And at the heart of it is a rejection of God and the church, whereas here in America, the revolutionaries, the founders, they understood that if you don't replace the bad sovereign with God, who's sovereign, you can't really achieve any of this. So that sounds, when you say the positive side, this is what you're talking about, I'm assuming.
Well, the two revolutions are fundamentally different.
Yeah.
So you start, their sources are different. The American Revolution comes from the Bible. The French Revolution comes from the French Enlightenment. Quite different. But then you start with the differences, the different views of humanity. So the American Revolution is realistic, as the Bible is, and the whole notion of checks and balances, separation of powers, ambition to counteract ambition, Madison learning from John Witherspoon, all that comes from a biblical view of fallibility. We are sinners. We go wrong. We do wrong. The French Revolution and the Russian and the Chinese are utopian. Remove the chains, Rousseau style, and we'll all be free. No, no. And there's a gap in the utopian revolutions between the real and the ideal. How do you close the gap? Through force, through violence. So the utopian revolutions are murderous. And you look at communism, it's killed more than 100 million people, partly because, essentially because, it's utopian.
Yeah. Well, in reading Thomas Paine's Common Sense, I was amazed because I thought, as I'm reading what he's writing about, that, you know, we are I ought to have it memorized by now, but the idea that this is going to be a new age in history, not since the days of Noah have we been able to remake everything, the world again, it'll be the birthday of a new world. All of that, apart from the realism, as you say, the biblical realism, that we're not angels, is utopianist madness. Mm-hmm. If you read it apart from that we need God to restrain our passions, we need to look to God, we need to govern ourselves, we need virtue, it reads like utopianist madness. And I guess it explains to me a little bit why Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson were lured by the siren song of the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Jefferson, fortunately, you know, retracted some of his early rather romantic views of revolution because he saw the huge differences. And I think Americans have got to think like Lincoln, you know, a house divided cannot stand. So you think of how much of American higher education or public schools and now increasingly young people are affected by socialism, radical socialism, cultural Marxism. But you look at this very dangerous red-green alliance. And that's the principal exposure after October the 7th. You know, you see this long march through radical multiculturalism, Marxism, joining hands with the long emergence of radical Islamism. And you know that in 1941, Hitler invited the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem to Berlin. And from then onwards, with the Muslim Brotherhood and so on, you've seen this radical Islamism. They're not only against Israel, against America, they're against the West. I would say they're profoundly against humanity. And yet the naivety of people listening to this, it's unbelievable. Now, the inroads in Europe are almost beyond the point of irreversibility. They aren't that bad here yet.
Yeah.
But compare, I first came here as a tourist in 1968. I met Mario Savio, who led the free speech movement. You know, I realized something was happening here in the counterculture. But, you know, all these years later, America is largely unrecognizable. And the naivety of Americans about the dangers of the left, and then the inadequacy of just critique. No, you've got to say what's wrong. We've got to know the alternative.
Well, that's interesting, this idea that the Marxist left, allied with the deconstructionists and the critical theorists, they're very good at criticizing. But as you say, they don't present a plausible alternative. They seem to think that if we tear away what we don't like, good things will emerge, unshackled. At the heart of it, of course, is an anti-biblical view that mankind is innately good and perfectible. And I guess we would say history has shown that not to be true.
To put it mildly.
To put it mildly.
Put it mildly, the pyramids of sacrifice. In other words, modernity created what Heinrich Heine calls the godless self-gods. That was his description of Karl Marx. And out of that has come the godless anti-God ideologies with Marxism, with fascism, and so on. And you can see how incredibly dangerous that is to humanity. And so we're up against that today, and we've got to pit that against it, a high view of human dignity. So we hold these truths to be self-evident? As you know well, they were not self-evident to even your great Greeks. Plato, some people are born gold, and some are silver, and some are bronze. And Aristotle, some are born to rule, and some are born to be ruled. You know, I remember going to India. The Dalits, they're untouchable. The Brahmins, fly above them. You know, that those founding principles are self-evident to readers of the Bible, but to nobody else. And we've got to go back to them and know why we believe in them.
Well, it's interesting because there are so, I write in my book about the misconceptions that people seem to think that, you know, Jefferson came up with these ideas.
No, no.
Or that these ideas leap from the French Enlightenment. And you think, no, 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 they do not. They come from the Bible. There's no way around it. And we have to at least be honest about this, that where would you ever get the idea that we're created equal, that we're made in God's image? That, I mean, those are such radical ideas. And it seems to me that because the men of the revolution all agreed on them, they weren't explicit about what a radical departure this is from all of the history that preceded it, unless you go back to
Sinai. You take things that are self-evident to you or common sense in your time, you don't bother to give the... But the key idea today is foundations. For me, one of the deepest is freedom. You know, the ancient world was ruled by fate. For the Babylonians, in your stars, or the Greeks, it was the Delphic Oracle, Oedipus. But people forget, for the modern world, there's no freedom either. For atheists, everything is determined. Marx, economic. Freud, psychological. Dawkins, genetic. Go on down the line. There isn't a leading atheist with a high view of freedom. Where does that come from? The Bible. Jews and Christians have the foundation, but a key thing in almost every area today is, why do you say that? You can't just assume it. Where's your foundation for it? Truth, beauty, goodness, freedom, human dignity. Go on down the line. We, Jews and Christians, readers of the Bible, we have the foundations for these things, which are the essentials for a human society. You know, with the world drifting towards totalitarianism, you've got the challenge of inhumanity. And now with the threat of AI, often commandeered by authoritarianism, you've got the equal challenge of post-humanity. And we who are followers of Jesus, we have a foundation for a truly free and highly human society, where we've got to fight for it.
Well, one of the reasons we're doing these Socrates in the City conversations around the revolution is because I think that during the 250th, there's an opportunity for everyone to look back. It's just one of those moments because it's such a big anniversary. It doesn't seem that that happened at the bicentennial.
No. Well, small ways. In other words, the temptation is to celebrate without reflection and self-examination. Mm. And that's the challenge this time. And for instance, there's been a lot of discussion here in town. Would there be Thanksgiving and confession and rededication? And there were some leading people who said, no, we don't want to confess. That's a sign of weakness. No, it's not. If you go wrong, do wrong. You know, even Michel Foucault, the great architect of postmodernism and power, he said he hated the Christian gospel, but there was one thing he respected, which was confession. Why? Because someone is going on record against themselves. And that's what's rare. I've screwed up.
Yeah.
That's rare. But when we go wrong, we've got to do that. And the American, it's no secret that the originals, we hold these truths, and they retain slavery. And Lincoln saw the contradiction. Mm. Martin Luther King, the promissory note, was all about the contradiction. Mm. In other words, we've got to repent and confess and be openly acknowledge where we've failed. And today, one obvious thing the American Republic has failed is passing it on. In other words, a free republic needs a double transmission. One, to every new generation, that's public education, collapsed. Howard Zinn, 1619 Project, young Americans haven't a clue what made America great. And then, of course, immigration. Open door policy is literally suicidal. Unless every new arrival is taught what it is to be American.
Yeah.
And of course, that wasn't the goal of the Democrats who brought people in. And they've literally undermined the very essentials of the Republic. And when some of these things have to be put right and fast,
yeah,
or the Republic cannot survive.
I'm again astounded, really, when I first heard you talk about this book, The Magna Carta of Humanity, Sinai's Revolutionary Faith and the Future of Freedom. It's maybe 3 years ago, I don't remember exactly, mm-hmm. but as has happened with you before, I was so astonished that I hadn't heard this before, and I'm always I'm embarrassed.
Well, you're
ashamed.
Honest enough to admit it, Eric. Very few people do.
Well, I, of course, it's true, and then I feel that I've got to tell the world this is so important. If I've missed this, my goodness, I'm so embarrassed. I can at least tell others about it.
Bold in their determination to learn, in their resourcefulness to solve problems, and in their resilience to persevere. These are the marks of today's Christian leaders. Cornerstone students are not only tomorrow's leaders, they are today's Christian influencers, serving on the front lines of healthcare, business, ministry, and so much more. Boldly loving as they live into their calling. Boldly leading with wisdom and influence while forging new pathways in our world. And boldly living out their faith in Jesus Christ, our greatest influencer. Bold, Christ-centered, influential. We are Cornerstone University.
The founders, again, because they understood this idea, because they knew they were looking back to the Sinai covenant, because it was covenantal, they didn't really feel the need to be explicit, to talk about it very much. And I think that's part of the problem, is that if you don't talk about it explicitly and clearly, it's possible to forget it. You mentioned how we began to go wrong, or I guess you were talking about Robert Billow's book, The Broken Covenant, is it?
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back. I mean, if I know that, you know, Samuel Adams and John Adams in particular really got this, really understood that it's about the Reformation, and we're looking back to that. They got that really clearly. What did happen that we drifted, that we began to drift away from that idea? Because you hear people always talk about classical Athens, the Roman Republic, and many of the founders referenced the Roman Republic like crazy. Not so much Sinai.
Well, you remember Alexis de Tocqueville, he says America has a double founding, twin foundings. So the obvious founding are the founders in the 18th century, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and so on. But he says the first founding is what he calls New England civilization, the Puritans. And coming particularly from Cambridge, I have to say, as an Oxford man, you know, the spreading of ideas through the famous White Horse Tavern, which is a pub, the ideas of covenant were everywhere then. And they were so much everywhere, people just took them for granted. And whenever things are taken for granted, you know, Moses warns the people at the very beginning in Exodus, when you've entered the land, and he tells them before they get into the land, and you've done it all, you think, one, we've done it ourselves, and two, it's going to last forever. That's a natural presumption. Mm. He says, you will have forgotten God. That's what that's what Lincoln said. That's what Solzhenitsyn said. We have forgotten God. No, we presume we've done it ourselves. And it's going to last forever.
Yeah.
It won't.
Yeah.
And we didn't.
And it's not lasting forever unless we do something about
it. Yeah. Now that, you know my idea, the three parts of a revolution: winning freedom, ordering freedom, and sustaining freedom. The golden triangle is the sustaining freedom. They're in Exodus. Winning freedom is Moses, let my people go. Ordering freedom is Sinai, the covenant, the Ten Commandments. And sustaining freedom was bringing in the tabernacle and the presence of God. And America has to have its own equivalent. Now, you've written a great book, Revolution. That's the winning freedom. And obviously, the glorious heroic stories are like that, like the crossing of the Delaware. You know, the ordering freedom, which is the Constitution, the covenant, that's harder to celebrate.
Yeah.
But the sustaining freedom, everyone forgets.
Yeah.
But that's our challenge now. The framers did the first. They did the second brilliantly. Our task is the third. But many people forget freedom is not easy to sustain, partly because the greatest enemy of freedom is always freedom.
That's the paradox. You write about it in A Free People's Suicide and elsewhere, and it's I learned it all from you. Say what is the golden triangle of freedom, because I think it really can't be said often enough. I've written about it because I discovered it in your book, A Free People's Suicide, and it's so central to everything we're talking about, if you don't mind.
Well, it's the answer to this third challenge. You win freedom, you order freedom, you've got to sustain it. Yeah. And that's the work of centuries and generations. Now, how did the framers do it? You look at, they didn't give it a name, but they all agreed on this, even the so-called deists. In other words, freedom requires virtue, first leg of the triangle. Virtue requires faith, the second leg, and faith requires freedom. And like the recycling triangle, it goes round and round. Freedom requires faith. Virtue requires faith, which requires freedom, which requires, and you're going round and round and round.
Well, explain, and I've explained this so many times in so many speeches, because it really is not something with which many people, unfortunately, are familiar. But the idea that freedom requires virtue, if you define freedom correctly, that if I don't want to be governed by someone else, I must govern myself. And to govern myself, why would I govern myself? Well, virtue. If I do the right thing when no one's looking, I'm a virtuous man. And all the founders said, and you quote them over and over, they all understood
they all
that
agree.
Idea.
Now, but each of those legs is thrown out today. Virtue, that's virtuocrats, people who want to impose their morality on it. No, they were talking about things like honesty and loyalty and so on. These are fundamental to a decent society. I trust you because you tell me the truth. You're not out to deceive me or, you know, cheat me or whatever. I trust you. Honesty is an incredibly important thing. Truth is essential for freedom. That's attacked today. And then the other links, too, each of them attack. You can see even now religious freedom, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech are under attack today.
Yeah.
In other words, freedom cannot be sustained unless these things are protected.
Mm. Well, I mean, the way I have explained it, again, this idea that if we're going to govern ourselves, then we have to be people of virtue. So I will do it when nobody is forcing me to do it. The government doesn't force me to do it. I can govern myself. We can govern ourselves because we aim to be people of virtue. The founders, and you've said this many times, they all saw that faith leads to virtue. And it didn't need necessarily to be explicitly Christian faith, even if you're part of a culture that believes in a higher order, that you do things because it's the right thing to do. It's what we do, but it requires a kind of faith. But then the last piece, how faith requires freedom. Talk about that, because it seems like a fundamentally Reformation idea.
Well, if you look at Europe, the deep degree of European secularity is because of reactions to corrupt established churches. Coercion. You think of the terrible medieval notion, error has no rights. And so you have not just canceling like we have today, you have censorship, you have inquisition, and you have people, Tyndale burned. Not only books were burned, people were burned. All of that is terrible. And the Reformation rediscovered Roger Williams, who was the founder of Rhode Island, the importance of freedom of conscience. What do we believe the world is? What's there? What's right and wrong before God? The inner conscience we have, that should be inviolable. And so religious freedom is the first freedom, and so on. These things are very basic, and if they go, freedom goes.
Well, it's, I mean, it's a fascinating thing because I, you know, that idea comes out of the Bible, but it takes time for us to get it out of the Bible. You know, it takes the Reformation, and after the Reformation, it's fascinating to me that these are biblical ideas, but that the church didn't get this until fairly recently.
And we've got to ask ourselves now, what is it that we're not getting? In other words, we're all more short-sighted than we realize, culturally and other ways, and we have to keep examining ourselves, and that's the one of the great, not only the scriptures, but we have the lessons of history, and we see things from the perspective of other people from other parts of the world, and we should be saying, how are we doing? Because we may be making, we must be making mistakes in our time, and we've got to examine ourselves.
Well, this idea of that you've so beautifully summed up in this phrase, this concept of the golden triangle of freedom, that is the only way that freedom, as you put it, is sustained. Mm-hmm. And I would say that culturally speaking, we were mostly doing fine for the first two centuries. But in the last 50 years, we've culturally drifted away from this. It was part of the culture, and that we have drifted away from it. Or would you agree with that, that we have drifted away from this principally in the last 50 years?
No, very much so. You look at the 60s, the counterculture was very restless with the 50s and all that they saw as American tradition.
Yeah.
Stuffy, uptight, you know, all that.
Yeah.
So you had a whole generation in favor of permissiveness in the interests of freedom. But it shifted from liberty to what the framers would call license.
Yeah.
And then you've had other ideas through the Long March, through the institutions. These are alien. It's not just the breakdown of the American ideas becoming permissive and loose and so on. No. Now we've been invaded by alien ideas, a different revolution. And unless they're countered, powerfully countered, the Republic's finished. Now, again, as an admirer of this country, you can see America shifting from republic to democracy. The framers weren't in favor of democracy, as you know. Now you even see a shift in the last months here in Washington from representative democracy to direct democracy. And the framers would have been horrified by that, and yet, you know, a previous candidate for the presidency of the Democratic side calling for direct democracy just by numbers without the Supreme Court and so on.
But isn't it shocking to you, Oz, that people could become United States senators and be ignorant of these most foundational ideas? I mean, it is at least shocking to me that's possible.
It's horrible. But you remember Mark Twain used to quip, "War is God's way of teaching Americans geography." You know, and Churchill would add, "And how about history?"
Yeah.
In other words, the great thing about 2026 and this semi-quincentennial is that it's an opportunity, a providential opportunity, because it gives us a baseline, 1776, and a benchmark. How, after 250 years, are we doing? And so people, look at your book. People have to engage with history, which is wonderful. Will they? A little bit.
Well, that's the hope.
The danger is they'll celebrate only.
Yeah.
Without the reflection of saying, where are we? This is, you know, there's never been a generation like the American founders. Every country has great men. You think of Solon or Pericles in Greece. You think of Churchill in England. We've had great men, usually individuals. You had a whole generation of them. They were amazing what they set up. But how are we doing today?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, because you're pointing to Sinai, there's been a resurgence of anti-Semitism. People who don't even want to say, it's so preposterous, they don't want to say Judeo-Christian, they just want to say Christian, which, of course, not a good look, because that's what the Nazis wanted to do. They wanted to cut the Judeo off Christian. And obviously, if you do that, you lose the whole thing. You can't have Christian without the Judeo. It's amazing to me that we're at that kind of a moment where some people are so ignorant and hostile to what we've known for the longest time. It's a bizarre phenomenon to me.
Oh, to me too, and outrageous, including many young Christians. But if you think, the early treatment of the Jews is the blackest stain on the conscience of the Christian church. But I'm partly proud as an evangelical. We evangelicals were restorationists since the Reformation. Cromwell invited the Jews back to England, talking covenant. Wilberforce was passionate about the restoration of Israel. You know, my great-grandfather was a friend of Lord Shaftesbury and Palmerston, people like that, the Balfour Declaration. They were Christian restorationists, actually, before there were Jewish Zionists. And the first Zionists were not religious. The religious people opposed Zionism. They were secular, like Theodor Herzl. So evangelicals have been pro-Israel and pro-restoration of Israel for several hundred years. And we need to recover that. And the younger Christians who are going the other way, being shaped by people like Nick Fuentes, Tucker Carlson, this is shameful. Shameful. Now, put simply, the Red-Green Alliance is anti-American as well as anti-Israel. Not to recognize covenantalism, the Hebrew Republic, and the whole legacy of that first founding through Israel is not only hateful through anti-Semitism, it's foolish. The Jews have given us the greatest ideas of freedom the world's ever seen. And to turn our backs on them is idiotic as well as evil.
I was amazed in reading Thomas Paine's Common Sense, because like so many people, you know, I'm guilty of being aware of everything, but never really looking more deeply. And so, I'm aware of Common Sense, but then to actually read it and to see him make the case of why monarchy is a bad idea, and it seems his principal argument is the Bible. It's clear that the Jews start out without a king, and they go wrong when they demand a king. And as Jesus says, you know, because of your hard-heartedness, you know, okay, well, you can have divorce, but it's not my will, but you can have it. It's the same thing with a king. But it's so fascinating to me that Thomas Paine points to that, and that because his American readers were so steeped in scripture that it hits them. Oh, yes.
But that's why he had to.
Yeah, well,
I think it's either Adams or Madison says to him, Tom, you're a hypocrite. You're an atheist. Why are you arguing from the Bible? Of course, he knows. He has to, because his readers all read their Bible, and they read that argument from Samuel. But that was at the heart of the English Revolution. You know, the leveler's idea, freedom is the man who turns the world upside down. Acts 17, these men who've turned the world upside down have come here. In other words, you have a view of revolution in England which is biblical. God creates order. Human beings create through sin disorder. So God works in a disordered world. He turns the disordered world upside down to turn it the right way up. And that's revolution. So you even have a resistance theology, which, of course, Jefferson loves. Resistance to tyrants is obedience to God.
Yeah.
That comes from Samuel Rutherford, comes from the Huguenot writings, Vindicii, and so on, justifying the challenge to tyranny. Now, people don't realize how much we owe. Goes back to the Bible and back to the Reformation rediscovery.
Well, I mean, as I say, I won't pretend that I have known this all along. I rediscover these things, and in my research for this book, I was really astonished at how clear that is. And there's some point in Common Sense where Thomas Paine says that the law will be the law of God. He makes it clear that the new sovereign, he doesn't quite say the new sovereign, as Samuel Adams says, you know, the new sovereign, capital S, is the King of Kings, is the Lord. Thomas Paine, in Common Sense, basically says will be the law of God. He goes that far. But he's talking about there's this transcendent reality before which we must bow. And if that is not the sovereign, there is no sovereign. It's every man for himself, and it's ultimately chaos and anarchy and bloodbath, which, of course, happens in the French Revolution. Why do you think Thomas Paine was lured into the French Revolution? Because I don't get the impression, really, that he was an atheist when he wrote Common Sense. Maybe he was.
Oh, I think he was.
You think he was?
I think he was masking it because he had, you know, a Christian audience he was writing to.
Yeah.
I think he came more explicit later on.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that. But there were people who thought that the French Revolution in its early stages was going to follow the American Revolution. And sadly, because of its fundamental ideas in the French Enlightenment, the divergence became clearer and clearer, and then irrefutable in the Reign of Terror.
Again, this contrast, you're contrasting Sinai and Paris. Say a little bit more about that, because I just think that idea needs to be more widely known. You've been saying it, but
you know, a lot of people say we're the product in the West of three cities.
Yeah.
Athens, Rome, and Jerusalem. And I read that in a Christian article of last week. It's not quite true. We're really the product of two cities, Athens, yes, you know that as a Greek, Rome, yes, and a desert. It was the burning bush and the smoking mountain. That's where I am who I am. Exodus 3:14 is radical. And this is where both atheism and that whole family of faiths, atheists, materialists, secularists, and our Eastern friends, Buddhism, all that stuff, Hinduism, they both agree there's nothing more than the cosmos. Sinai says no. God is transcendent as creator of it all. And nothing, even the sun and the moon and the stars, can't be used to represent him. They're idols. They're nothings compared with him. So Sinai is a singularity. And when the Lord reveals himself, there's something very unusual there. He reveals himself to the entire nation of Israel. That's never ever happened before or since.
It's pretty
It'll
dramatic.
Happen at the end days when the Lord returns.
You write about the civilizational breakthrough of Sinai. I'll say for the fifth time that until I heard it from you, I had never heard of things framed this way, which really tells you how far we've drifted from all understanding this. Do you think that most people that Lincoln understood this? Again, I'm curious how we drift away from this central idea.
Well, Lincoln had an incredible view of God. In other words, the Sinai Revolution, the key thing, that the Lord is a partner. He's a partner to the covenant. The American Constitution and covenant, as Lincoln says, is under God, not with God. That's very important. In other words, accountability. But as you know, you read all Lincoln's writing, his sense of accountability, the way the Civil War is measure to measure the justice of God because of all that had happened through slavery. He has an incredible sense of the divine accountability and so on. Now, his great lodestar is the Declaration. The Declaration said these things, we're not living up to them. And slavery is wrong in the light of the Declaration. Mm. And, you know, he quotes Psalm 83 or whatever it is about tongue sticking to his mouth and song. If he's unfaithful to the Declaration in Philadelphia, he has a remarkable sense both of the Declaration, but also of that sovereign accountability of God.
It's amazing to me how the way I think of it is that you know, Gettysburg, he says, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So he's pointing back in a sense, the way I see it, he's saying that, you know, if you don't know where the where true north is, I've got to point you back. Otherwise, we're drifting away. So he points back not to the Constitution, but to the Declaration, and he basically says that if you're not getting this right, you're drifting. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that's where we are again. I guess I always think of that we're in the third existential crisis of our history. The first is the Revolution. The second is the Civil War, and that we're roughly now in that third existential crisis. So we, in order to succeed and not to cease to be, we have to look back. Mm-hmm. And that's really what you've done in this book, is you show us whence we come, from whence we come. And I want to say again, Oz, I'm just amazed how little known, how little spoken of this is. I'm always a little amazed at your acting as though, oh, many others know this, but I, at the risk of embarrassing you more, I think that apart from you, very few people are talking about this.
Well, yeah, the Jews are, and they're beginning to realize, as they're attacked with anti-Semitism and so on, they realize that they have a huge stake here in this country. But I think as Christians, we should be aware of this. I'm appalled how little, you read Skip Stout at Yale, you know, 40,000 hours of Puritan sermons, no counter voices, no radio, no television, no social media. Imagine it. And that notion of covenant comes again and again and again and again and again. And yet preachers today don't know it.
Right.
Unbelievable to me. I think of our own church. They did a great series on Genesis, and then when it came to Exodus, all they did was the Ten Commandments. Well, it's like putting the Constitution without the Revolution. You know, there was just zero understanding of freedom that way. But we are not only the heirs of these things, we are the custodians and guardians of them today. So I'm, having grown up in China and seen the Reign of Terror there, authoritarianism. You take Nietzsche. You want a name for my world? The last words of Nietzsche. This world is the will to power and nothing besides. That's where the world's going. Authoritarianism, unbridled power. Where's the counter? In the American Republic. Who's standing for it? Even the right. I mean, one of the White House talked about these ideals as international niceties. They're not. They're principles. They're foundational principles. And if we lose them, we're in trouble. So I think we should fight. They're biblical. They're American. And they're the best counter to the dangers of authoritarianism. So now is the time to stand.
It seems to me that you're at least somewhat hopeful. I'm quite hopeful in a way, but you have been prophetic in trying to warn American leaders about this. So, what is your sense of where we're going? You talk about this in your newer book, America Agonistes. What is your sense, if you don't mind, before we end?
Well, actually, my newest book, which came out last week, is called A Freedom Like No Other. And rather than decrying the darkness, I've tried to describe 12 of the biblical covenantal principles. And they're things that can be taught very simply. They should be second nature, common sense, to Christians and other citizens. And we need to rebuild those again. But we haven't long. It's later than most Americans think. If, for example, and you can see, put it this way, the problems of the left are very, very clear. If the right doesn't lead to a transformation, if we only have a pushback, and there's a pushback the other way,
yeah,
it will accelerate the left.
Yeah.
That's why the time is short. And we've got to think positively. We've got to think first principles. We've got to go back to the foundations of freedom and not just say how great the Republic is and so on, but say, what do we need to put right? It's an urgent time. I don't see a lot of people responding. I'm here living in Washington. Celebration, yes, a lot of it. Reflection, not very much. Self-examination, even less. And confession, hardly at all.
Well, the fundamental idea that you're putting forth, this idea of it all beginning at Sinai, it's not complicated. That's what amazes me. It's not at all complicated.
Not at all.
But until now, very few people have known about it. I'd like to think that as a result of this conversation, as a result of your book, and to a lesser extent, as a result of my book, that we will have some success in reintroducing what unfortunately is extremely important to people in America. And of course, it's always been my hope, and I assume yours too, that these ideas will spread beyond
Absolutely.
America, and that maybe we will have people in the UK pick up this banner and finally realize
yep.
this is the only way forward.
And through the global church, we've got to be able to stand for the ways of the Lord, including human dignity and freedom, against the appalling specter of what's in the wings.
Oz, it's just a joy to have you. I want to say on behalf of millions, thank you for this book and for the work that you do. It is unfortunately very important, but fortunately you've done the work, and I hope these ideas will spread like wildfire. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.